Now it is, no? It is turned off. Is that better? Okay. So, as I said, I'm not going to talk about any algebraic object, but I will talk about something related to random matrices, and for the probabilists, what I'm going to say is actually essentially known. But I thought it's nice and of some pedagogical interest, I guess. It comes from actually a joint project with Greg Anderson and Steve. But all mistakes in what I'm going to describe today are mine, and there is at least one mistake, so that I will tell you towards the end. Okay, so what is the question I want to discuss? So we take a random matrix. For the moment, I don't want to specify. Well, actually, let us order them. And I will keep forgetting the superscript N later. And so they form, and this random matrix, say, Hermitian matrix, so such that the eigenvalues are real. So these eigenvalues form a point process on the line. Sasha mentioned that in his introductory talk on Monday. And people have been asking all sorts of questions about this process, of course, and of particular interest, and it was discussed in this conference in a few talks, is what happens at the edge, namely near the largest eigenvalue. But I want to ask the question about what happens in the bulk, so going back in history, really, maybe 15 or 20 years before the questions about the edge. So I'm interested in spacings. So suppose here is a point zero. The basic question you want to ask is what is lambda I plus 1 minus lambda I, lambda I plus 1 minus lambda I, how does it behave? And of course, in the context of GOE and GUE and the classical ensemble, this question is well understood, and it goes back to Godin and Mehta. And I'm not completely sure about the history of this, who was the first who actually wrote down the equations for the spacing. But if you look at what is being done, then typically what is computed is an object like that. What is the probability that there is no eigenvalue in minus TT when you properly rescaled? So when you rescale eigenvalues such that the average of lambda I plus 1 minus lambda I near zero is 1. Okay, so you risk it, which in for the GUE, this means, so if your GUE is scaled such that the whole spectrum is between 2 square root n and minus 2 square root n, this means rescaling the spacing by an additional square root n, so that the average spacing is of order 1. Okay? So this quantity, which of course depends on n, what typically you show by using the machinery of Fredholm determinants, etc., on which I will say something a bit later, what you typically show is that this converges to some function g of t. And that is very satisfactory, and it's a very nice theory, but in fact, what people are interested in is really not this quantity. because when people were investigating random matrices, and certainly in connection with number theory, they were asking about, let's take a bunch of spacings and let's ask about the histogram, or in probabilistic language, the empirical measure. So the question the natural question is, what is the relation between this object and that empirical measure? And now if you go and open the literature, you discover that this is kind of folklore, and there are some formula, but if you actually chase a proof, so there is a heavy combinatorics machinery that can be used to get the proof. You open, for example, Katz and Sarnak, who do these kind of things, and you discover it's long and involved and not so short. And so what I wanted to do today is to tell you an approach that will give you that as a byproduct, and that I find of some. This doesn't move. Okay. So I will write here. Or does it move? Anybody knows? Is there an electric switch? It's a two. Move. Somewhat successful. Okay. So before I describe that, I want to go back to something that many of you know, and if you don't, then it's something nice to know, which is this bus waiting paradox. So what is a bus waiting paradox? So suppose the buses arrive as a Poisson process, which means an exponential time between buses. Okay? So what is, and suppose an exponential time of mean one. So what this means is that buses arrive as an IID process. The inter-arrival time, the time between one arrival and the next, is an exponential random variable. It's an IID sequence. Okay? So how long will we wait for a bus on average? Well, 1 unit of time. Okay? But ask yourself, what is the size of the interval without buses exactly when you arrived? So the buses start at some point at minus infinity, so whatever that means, so you have a nice ergodic process. But now what I'm really asking is, I have the point zero, and I'm asking, what is the size of that, of the interval around zero? And this should be, this should remind you of the computation we did before, because that's really the computation that is being done here. You pick a point zero, you ask the size of the interval around it, you ask the probability of the largest interval without a point. Actually, it's not exactly the same question, because here I took a symmetric interval, but it's a closely related question. So if you ask yourself that question, there are two trains of thought, right? One is to say, well, it's an interval, so the mean is one. And you should then now scream murder. No, that's the wrong answer. Why is that the wrong answer? Because the exponential random variable is memoryless. So if I know that no bus arrived up to this point, the residual time has the same distribution. So the time I still have to wait for the bus has the same distribution. So the distance here is again exponential 1. So this distance is exponential 1. And because this process is completely symmetric with respect to time reversal, also this distance is exponential 1, and the two are independent. So the distance is actually of mean 2. The sum of two independent random variables. And in fact, it does not have an exponential distribution. So that interval around zero is special. Again, those who opened the book of Meta or classical books will see that phenomena. There are equations that describe this difference. But I just want to point out that there is a very good reason why it is different. And I want to systematize this question, but now not for independent processes, of course, but also for the processes that we want to deal with in random matrices. So for that, some definition. So a simple point process let me be a bit vague. I don't want to make it. In principle, it's a measure-valued random variable, but for us, it's just a configuration of points. Configuration of points without multiplicity. So no two points on the same location, exactly like our random matrices. And then, if you define by chi of d the number of points in d, then the intensity functions, also called the correlation functions, are simply defined, if you have di disjoint, they are simply defined by so those are called the correlation, the intensity functions. And you should think of them indeed as a probability to find a point in x1 in a small interval around x1 and around xk. Okay. Now from this formula you can actually read fractional moments. You can read from it not just the if k is equal to 1, this gives you the expected value of chi of d, so the expected value of number of points, but you can actually compute from this formula all the statistics you care about. So this carries all the information you want. For example, fractional moments of the chi's can be read off this formula. Now, the process is called determinantal. If the intensity function rho k of x1 up to xk is the determinant of a kernel. Okay, and the interesting thing is, of course, when k is greater or equal to 2 in that. And the theory of determinantal processes, there is one C or two C's? I think two C's. And there's a very nice review paper of Sasha, and there are other papers, and then there is a nice review that I... let's see. So off. Paris and Viron have a nice review and all sorts of new points of view on determinantal processes. What is interesting in our context is, of course, GUE is determinantal, but also with a proper interpretation, if you take A plus GUE, that is also, where A is fixed, that is also determinantal by, I think Sasha already mentioned it at that. And what is nice with determinantal formulas is that that object can be written very easily in terms of a Fredholm determinant. So for determinantal processes, the probability of no points in D is just the Fredholm determinant of 1D K1. Okay. And of course, the Fredholm determinant is, so when I write delta of k, this should be understood with all the caveats. This object, whatever that means. And the nice thing is that Fredon determinants have good approximation properties. Namely, if you control in a suitable norm the difference between two kernels, the Fredon determinants also are bounded. The difference of the Fredon determinant is bounded. And for the purpose of this talk, the suitable norm will be the supremum norm. Now, there is a special class of determinantal processes that will be of interest to us, which are the translation invariant. Let me write here. So the translation invariant determinantal processes, and these are just coming from kernels in which k of x, y is simply k of x minus y. And a particularly important example for us is a fine kernel, which is fine. So I'm going to make a mistake with the pi, so I hope that's correct, but there may be a pi too much or too little. By the way, this is not an innocent. This is not an innocent thing. For a process to be determinantal, there are very stringent conditions on k, and just rescaling k may cause problems. So, okay. Now we say that the process is mixing. The point process is mixing if for local sets A, B, so by local I mean that they look only in a compact set in space, the probability that your configuration is in A intersect with the configuration is in a shift of B converges to the product. Well, this is a shift. And such processes have very nice properties. In particular, they are ergodic, and averages converge to the expectation. Okay. And then you check that if K is translation invariant, and K of X goes to zero, X to infinity, then you have mixing. I'm omitting some conditions. Of course, K should define a good process. Not every K you will give me will define a good process. This is again a consequence of these differences that I told you before, the nice property of the Fredon determinant, and in particular Hadamard bound, gives you all you need to know in order to prove that. Okay, so that's the object that is going to appear later. Let's go back to point processes. So with point processes, there are really two notions of stationarity that are relevant. Again, this is very well known to anybody who worked with point processes. The two notions are the following. One is a spatial shift. That's exactly the shift that we were discussing here. I just moved the R axis around. The other is, if I look at it as a sequence, xi, xi plus 1, etc., then I can do a shift by shifting the index. Okay? The second shift is the one you take when you create histograms. Because what do? When you create histograms, you look at successive differences and you ask yourself about the statistic of these successive differences. So there's an issue here. How do you go from spatial shift, for which the original process was translation invariant, to a shift here? And the basic idea, I mean, the transfer from one to the other is by what is called the PAL measure of the process. And very, so I'll give a definition, but very, before I give the definition, what you should just think is, let's look at the process conditioned on having a point at zero. Okay? If you're conditioned on having a point at zero, the natural shift now is to go from one point to the next. And this introduces so that's the PAL measure. So the process conditioned to have a point at zero. So if I had the process X to start with, the process, so X is a configuration of points, and I should call it X, to be consistent with what I did before. So this I will call X naught, to remind us that it has a point at zero. And the law, the PAL measure associated, is such that Q of A is just the expected value of the integral . So this is a spatial shift ds. I'll explain what I mean here. So this is just the random measure that puts Dirac's on locations of points. And it's a small lemma to prove that this definition actually does not depend on the set B that you choose here as soon as this expectation is positive. So this does not depend on B. And if you think of B as being a tiny interval around the point, you get the interpretation I told you before, which is just conditioned on having a point at zero. Okay? So that's a PAL measure associated with the process. And now, there's a very general fact that relates to this. The process if the PAL measure is known, can go back to original process and the going back is a very simple procedure, so let me describe you how you do it. Okay? So you take your PAL process, which is the process under the PAL measure, so this is a process in which there is a point at zero with probability one, that's how it was constructed. And now you look at the interval at how far you can go, say to the right, before you hit a new point. So let me draw the picture. So this is zero. Here we have a point x10, etc. And now what you do is I'm going to describe to you a change of measure that will take you from the PAL measure to the original one. What you do is you sample this object sized bias. What does that mean? The larger this thing is, the more probabilistic weight you put.
So you define a new measure, dq bar to dq, dq naught. Q naught was a measure of the Palm process, simply by x1 naught. And to make it a probability measure, of course, you have to divide it by the expected value of x1 naught under q naught. But let's suppose that the expected value of x1 naught is just 1 throughout, so that I have normalized everything, so that I have that, and this factor is not here. And this is a Radon-Nikodym derivative, and this is a concept of size biasing. So you take that interval, you sample it size biased, and then you create a new process by just choosing a starting point uniformly inside that interval. So then you shift to a random uniformly chosen point. Okay, so you get a new configuration. The new configuration is with a random point here. But I emphasize that the law of this initial segment is not the same as the original law. So let's just go back to the bus example. What happens in the bus example I told you about in the very beginning? In the bus example, the Palm measure is exactly IID, exponential random variables. Because if you condition to have a bus at a certain point, what happens from that point on is you have an arrival process of buses, which is IID exponential. That was our assumption. What happens when you size bias an exponential? What is the density you get? Well, instead of the density e to the minus x, which is exponential, you get x times e to the minus x. Okay? Which is the density of the sum of two exponentials, which is exactly what we saw. Okay? Good. So in exponential, in Bass's example, the size biasing creates the shift in mean. And that's not so surprising. You put more weight on longer intervals. So that's what happens. Okay. Now, from this also, you see, well, if the process is mixing, then of course what happens far from the origin does not really depend on what happens at the origin. So even if you started from the size bias version, which is the version I told you now, then if your process is mixing, the long-term averages will actually behave as if you are under the Palm measure, not the original measure. Okay? So if you're interested in long-term averages, for example, in the bus example, if the way you do your statistics is you send a sampler at noon to interview and find out how long was it before the previous bus came and how long was it until the next bus came, and you look at that number and average those numbers, you'll get a biased answer. On the other hand, if you go and tell the sampler to be there from noon until noon the next day, and just to average the length, what they will see is indeed exponential 1. In fact, in the IID example, after the first interval, they will just see IID 1 variables. But if the process has dependencies, that's not true. The size biasing here will influence the next intervals, but it will influence the next intervals in a way that you can compute, and such that the long-term averages will be the ones coming from the Palm measure. So what this means is that if you create for a stationary process like that Fn of t. So if you define fn of x, so for a function f defined to be just the averages from xi in 0 n of f txi x. So I hope it is clear what I mean here. You shift your sequence x by xi. So you bring back your points to the origin by each time by shifting to the next point. So for example, this local function f could be the spacing. Could be a function of the space from 0 to the next point. Okay, so f is a function of configuration. So you do that and you divide by the number of I such that xi is in 0n. This should converge to eq, or eq not, I think I denoted it. And that's true, that's a corollary for mixing processes. Okay. So, from this formula, you can actually relate, you can give an answer to what I, so this is one corollary. Another corollary, that you can also prove by using just a Fredholm machinery, but in a more complicated work, is that if you look at the gap, if you look at the following two objects, if you define G to be the distribution function of x1 of the gap, sorry, of the gap near zero. Sorry. If you define the following, if you define G bar to be just the probability that no G bar of T to be the probability that no zero, no point in minus tt, so no point of the point process is between minus t and t, then you obtain dg bar to dt equal to minus 2 the integral from 2t to infinity, or if you want q of minus of 2t infinity, well, this is the distribution of x1 naught. So this is a next point in the Palm measure. Okay, so it's the first point after zero. So again, in the Bass example, this would be the exponential. And this will be not quite the gap around zero, but something related to it. It's the size of the symmetric gap around zero, which has the law of the minimum of two exponential random variables. And in that example, you can check just by hand that this formula is true, but this formula is completely general. So what is the advantage of this kind of formula? By the way, if you open Mehta's book, you will find this formula, of course, proved by analytical methods. What is the advantage of this formula? Well, it allows you to relate the computation you do easily by Fredholm determinant machinery, Penleve, and all that. Actually, the Penleve equations are giving exactly information about this quantity to quantities that will involve long-term averages, because the measure Q bar is the one that will appear in long-term averages. Okay. Once you know that, let's go back to the question I started with. So suppose we have a sequence of kernels. Suppose we now have a sequence of kernel KNXY. What you should have in the back of your mind is, for example, GUE, So those Kn's are sums of harmonic oscillator functions. And you have a kernel Kx minus y, which is translation invariant. And now you ask yourself, how can I say something about Kn if I have information about K? Remember, averages under K are easy to get, because under K the process is mixing. Long-term averages give you results on are given in terms of the marginal, in terms of the distribution of the palm distribution associated to K, but this we saw that we can compute by this formula. So suppose I have now a point process Xn, and here I have a point process X. Typically, this point process will be a finite point process. For example, in GUE, we know it has exactly n points, right? So in particular, it's the configuration is always compactly supported. Long-term averages don't make sense. If I take really very long-term averages, then at some point I stop being able to average because I exhausted all my points. This one actually does have good properties because there's an infinite number of points. And from all I told you so far, suppose that the Kn converges to K in such a way that if you fix D1 up to DK compact, the law of the vector X restricted to D1, X restricted to DK, converges to X restricted to D1 up to X restricted to DK. And if you take D1 up to DK compact, all you need for that is really that KnXY converges to that in supremum normal compacts. That will immediately translate via Hadamard bound to the statement of convergence configured. But that's, of course, not quite enough, because you want to deal with increasing sets in Kn. Right? You want to have an empirical average, so in numerical experiment for zeros of zeta functions that eventually get related, what do? You take a large number of zeros in the process, and you want to compare it to a large number of zeros that you take from a sample of a random matrix. Okay, so we have to quantify what does large mean, and what is large compared to the size of the matrix. And now I showed you all the tools you need in order to do that. You need to be able to control approximations of processes by approximation of kernels. But you need to do it not just on compact sets. So at the end, what I want to say is the following theorem. So suppose that small n is little order of capital N, and then I would say plus extra conditions. So originally I thought that is enough. Now I'm not sure. So to be safe, I will say what I am sure is little order of log N is okay. But I don't think you need to go just to log N, but just to make sure that I write a correct statement of the problem. I think this can be much improved. Anyway. And suppose also that you have the following, that the Lim soup, as n goes to infinity, the supremum over x plus y less than a n, so for all a positive, you have then this in zero. Okay. Then if you create the empirical average, so if you take G N T N to be just 1 over N, the sum from 1 to N of G of so define Y I to be X I plus 1 minus X I. So here I will write G of Y I. So those are successive spacings. This will converge to the expected value under the measure related to K of G of X naught, X1. And this is a Paul measure, so I should put here a 0. Okay? That's a statement. And the proof, as I said, is that you just pull what you need from this statement to carry a claim about convergence, not just on compact sets, but on sets that are larger than compact, that grow essentially like that. And the place where you need this type of result is, of course, you pick an error term that depends on the size of your terms, and you want to make sure that it does not screw up the computation. Okay, so that's the result I wanted to tell you. In particular, it applies. You can check these conditions for in this setup, and so get a statement about convergence of large empirical averages of GUE, but at level capital N. I want to make two additional comments. One is that I have described everything to determinantal processes. I am not sure yet. I suspect that something very similar can be done for Fassian processes, or for processes that would arise, say, from the GOE, but this has not been done. And in fact, if people here know about where such statements have actually been proved, I'm interested in knowing. I've not found statements like that in the literature, but I would like to. I'm sure there are. It's just that I'm not aware of that. And, well, I think that will be it. So I'll stop here.